Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the journalist and academic Kurt Barling. Kurt started his career as a lecturer, but was later inspired to go into journalism by the Broadwater Farm riots and the need for rigorous news reporting. Joining the BBC in 1989, he would go on to work there for more than 25 years, most notably special correspondent for BBC News London, where he investigated some of the capital's most difficult stories, including Muslim radicalisation post 9/11, child trafficking, and practices of witchcraft in African churches. Now Professor of Journalism at Middlesex University London, he has also been deeply critical of underrepresentation at the BBC, headed up documentary production company People Focus, and has written a number of books, including The R Word, Racism. Kurt, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Paul.
Where have you found time to do all of that?
I have no idea. And I've raised three children at the same time, been married to the same woman for 36 years, and kept her happy. So obviously I've been doing something right. I'd put it down to my upbringing.
Well, and also you're a very handsome man. She's clearly done very well for herself. So she puts
a paper bag over my head every evening, so there's no question of looks involved in that.
What does a professor of journalism do?
Professors.
Great answer.
A bit like a preacher, you know.
Yeah.
The reality is that when I went to university in the early 80s, people used to do things like philosophy and economics and international relations and English. But, of course, the world would be a boring place and everyone who went to university now, one out of every two children enter school age 11, will end up going to university. Back in the day when I was going to university, it was 5% of the age group going to university. So if you imagine having all those children coming out as philosophers and historians and English graduates, the place would be boring. Nobody would be creating any wealth. We'd all be unemployed and it'd be a complete misery. So in order to expand the higher education sector, what we've done is we've looked elsewhere for ways in which to encourage young people to think about their futures. Journalism is just one of those things. There are lots of people who said, of course, over the years that media studies, what on earth is that? Why do you want to do that anyway? There are no jobs out there for journalists. Phooey. Hogwash, rubbish. There are plenty of jobs out there for expert communicators. We live in a world where communication is critical, and we can provide young people with the understanding of those skills needed through doing degrees, for example, in journalism. But let's be honest, what's the difference between studying philosophy and studying journalism? In reality, there is no difference if you're trying to encourage people to be critical thinkers. You're just providing them with different source material to do with that. Some people are big snobs about, well, if you do philosophy, of course, you'll go all the way back to the classics. You'll do Plato and all the rest of it. But the reality is that does not necessarily make students great critical thinkers. You can find all sorts of ways in getting students to be critical thinkers. My daughter's just graduated with a degree in fashion design.
Well, she wants to be a fashion designer. That sounds like a good degree.
She doesn't actually want to be a fashion designer.
Ah, right.
But she's built up a huge range of skills in problem solving as a consequence of that degree. My son has graduated at the same time in the more traditional subject of philosophy, politics and economics.
He's not on the West Coast kind of seeking his fortune, isn't he?
He is, but the point there is in what the process they both went through played to their different strengths. They both came out of university with a degree. They've both become critical thinkers and problem solvers. And it just goes to show that we need a mixed economy in higher education if we are to serve young people of Britain and Europe, because inevitably lots of European students and international students come to universities like Middlesex, but all the other universities in Britain. We're very good at that. And this is a way of making sure that students are engaged in their studies, and when they graduate, they can then choose the pathway that will give them fulfillment in life.
So if I wanted to be a journalist and I was starting out in my career, would it be better to do a degree in journalism, or would it be, like you say, do PPE or history or something else? I mean, there must be some advantage to actually having a degree in journalism if you want to be a journalist.
Look, in the end, it's horses for courses. If you come out of school with three A-levels with A-star grades, you have the choice of the field. You can go and do a traditional critical thinking degree at Oxford or Cambridge or Durham or Manchester, Warwick, wherever it might be, Russell Group as they call it. Or you might not be quite so gifted at school and you come out with two B's and a C. which means you have to make different decisions. And you might go and do a degree in journalism at Nottingham Trent or Middlesex University London or Sussex or wherever. The point is that it's horses for courses. Choose the course that's going to stimulate you most. If you are a reader and you want to read text and you want to discuss text, you want to get involved in critical thinking seminars, go for a traditional degree. If you want to get your hands-on experience, if you want to get your hands dirty, you want to get internships, go for a degree in journalism, a practical-oriented degree, because that suits some young people better. And in the end, it's not like being an apprentice, because you're not just being trained technically. You'll be given the thinking skills, which what a university degree gives you. But the reality is it will inspire some students to pursue a degree using that kind of approach rather than that traditional Russell Group approach. And, you know, some people will come out from Middlesex University London and be fantastic journalists. Some people will come out from Oxford and be fantastic journalists. I have to say, I work with a lot of journalists at the BBC over my 25 years career from Oxbridge, and I wasn't always impressed with them. So, you know, for my money, the reality is it's about the individual and how well they've been trained, how critical thinking they are, how much they are engaged in wanting to do good in the world through the route of journalism. That's what makes a good journalist.
So just going back to the question of what you do as professor of journalism, is it mainly teaching? Are you kind of churning out the journalists of tomorrow, or is there other kind of extracurricular activities? What's the core function of your job?
The university trains young people in how to do the job of journalism.
And you're at the
centre
of that.
But that's the start of it. Mm. And my role is to try and make sure that what is being taught is industry relevant. That is to say that I have good connections in journalism, and so I can put students in touch with the BBC or London Live or ITN or independent production companies and say, go and get some experience there. This is what you need to build up your confidence, come back into the university environment in September, and we'll make sure that you get the intellectual training that you need to carry out those practical functions. So my job is to provide the university with expertise sourced in professional practice. Now, sometimes that means a bit of teaching, some master classes and the like, but also it means looking outwards and making sure that industry recognises that what we're trying to do is make the degrees that students get directly relevant to what their needs are, but not training them as apprentices, giving them some hands-on experience, but at the same time teaching them how to think critically. I mean, I do something called Broadcasting Today, which is a web-based broadcast where I interview well-known people in the industry. It's produced by students. It's a bit like a parky format talk show.
A bit like this format,
yeah. Except it's on television in the TV studio. Students edit it, turn it around, put it on the on YouTube. And the purpose of it is to get interesting people into the university, but also give students hands-on experience of making productions work. Being in a live context, seeing the excitement and the buzz, it's fun. It should be fun. Of course, it can be serious too if you've got Saddam Hussein in front of you. But the reality is it's supposed to be a job which gives you high levels of motivation, and you want to introduce them to that, not in a sterile environment, but an active environment in a live production setting. And my phrase often when I do those productions is, this is a way at Middlesex University how we teach students how to think, but also how to do. And that's the key. It's combining those two things to make students fit for purpose when they've got their degree. And hopefully by the time they've finished after 3 years, they kind of have a sense of what direction they want to travel in. That doesn't mean they are the finished article. They're not going to come out and be a Paxman or a Snow. They're going to come out and think, I would like to be a Paxman and a Snow, and I know what route I've got to travel in order to get there.
Do you think students going through your course nowadays have it harder than, say, the students of, say, 20 or 30 years ago? Because in one sense, it's easier. You know, they've got different ways to get on the attention of people like yourself and producers and programme planners, blogging and so on. But in another sense, the competition is much more fierce, isn't it?
I think the access points are much more extensive. In 1989, when I left the LSE, I struggled to get heard because the points of access were so limited. And the reality is the LSE pedigree gave me a bit of pulling power, but it was very difficult to get over the credibility gap that, you know, the BBC producers wanted when they saw this working class lad with a good degree, or actually I had 3 degrees by then. In fact, that was almost a turn-off, you know. PhD, what do you want to be a journalist for? You know, we don't need people like that in journalism. You know, yeah. Just disrupt it. It'll be too subversive. But the reality is, it was fiendishly difficult for everybody to get in the business then, get a foothold. Now the points of access not only are more varied, but the reality is, whilst you're a student, you can pick up the skill set that's required more readily and broadcast. I mean, it's not broadcast in the sense of you're broadcasting to a million people, but even if you're only doing an audio podcast, which is picked up by 150 people, you're getting yourself in tune with what's required.
Oh, we dream of having 150 listeners, obviously.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, 155. But the reality is that students, if they are given the right tools, can now broadcast very quickly. I've just finished a film called Hidden Heroes of Empire. It's a 16-minute film, which is produced by our students, looking at soldiers from the Empire in the First World War. All part of my approach, if you like, to encourage students to think out of the box, look at the alternative narratives in history, looking at, in this case, black soldiers from the Empire who fought for the Middlesex Regiment. And we put together a really powerful 16-minute documentary. I didn't have that opportunity. When I did my degrees at LSE, you know, I was in the British Library of Political Economic Science with my nose in books, mostly sneezing because they were covered in dust. The reality is, when I came out, I had a very sharp mind, but I had not a clue.
And a dusty nose.
And a dusty nose. Yeah. But no clue how to make radio or make television or make films. Not a clue.
And now they do.
And now they have every opportunity to get their hands dirty. And there are platforms, because of the digital landscape, on which they can project that. And woe betide those who actually don't do that by the time they come out of university, because there's no excuse. And therefore, they should have a pretty good idea when they come out of what their capacities are and the routes they might travel to get their foot in the door. It's still hard work. Ironically, of course, there's more work, but fewer jobs. You know, the jobs that we sought in the 80s, which might give us 25 years on staff or 30 years on staff.
They're non-existent now.
Well, they're not non-existent, but there are no more of them. But there's more work available. Of course, in the first 10 years of your working life, you don't necessarily need a job where you can pay the mortgage, because you're about taking risks at that point in your life. So actually, in many ways, it's no different from when we were going into the workplace in the 80s. In a sense, it's always been a challenge. The reality is, we live in interesting times. They need to be reported properly. There is a job to be done in journalism, to be done properly. Students are as well equipped now as they have ever been. The airways are more vibrant. Therefore, there's more opportunity not to just be dominated by singular narratives, but to engage in a broader discourse about the world we live in, and students can get themselves involved in that. And the more the merrier.
You're a professor of journalism, so I don't feel quite an idiot asking you this, but I've never really asked anyone else this. What is a journalist these days? Because, I mean, are the lines as clear as they always were? Or is it blurring? You know, is Guido Fawkes a journalist? Is this journalism? Is it someone who writes about, you know, writes a blog about their local council who's just doing it in an amateur sense? Is that journalism these days? Because, you know, it is quite a difficult question to answer now, would you say?
Journalism is a varied trade. It's always been a varied trade. The fact of the matter is, just because you can talk till the cows come home on a radio microphone doesn't make you a journalist. And of course, there's an awful lot of tosh talked on the airways, and that is not necessarily journalism. In its essence, journalists are storytellers who apply critical thinking to those stories. So they try and assess the evidence before them and present it to an audience in the fairest possible light. Now, obviously, we know that it's always been the case that certain institutions mediate that message in a certain way. So if you write for The Sun or The Times or The Telegraph, you're not going to mediate news or stories in the same way as if you write for The Independent, even though it's online now, or The Guardian or The Morning Star. So there's always been a variety of journalism. Is Guido Fawkes a journalist? He's a very intelligent man, and he will present a position in the way he feels fit. And I suspect, of course, if you go back to the original notion of journalism 300-400 years ago with the sheets that used to come out on Fleet Street, around Fleet Street, and they try and, you know, there'd be dozens of people trying to flog their sheets of news. What's the difference? There is no difference. We've become more accustomed to seeing journalists as people who work on newspapers or for the BBC or for ITN or more latterly Sky or Al Jazeera. Yes, they're journalists too. But journalism, I'm not a journalism snob, frankly. I think those people who can prepare stories and present stories and do it with a certain amount of judgment are entitled to call themselves journalists.
Do you sneer at any journalists? I mean, the obvious example would be, say, Fox News. That although they're presenting packages, they're clearly very right-wing. And to their credit, they don't try to hide that, but it's extremely opinionated and some would say potentially dangerous. Are they journalists?
Even in the Third Reich, there were people who were, you know, telling stories and spinning a yarn. And they had the tag of journalists, and I guess they were journalists. We live in a plural, open society. In a plural, open society, just because people make a lot of noise and you don't agree with them doesn't mean you sneer at them and say they're not journalists. You have to have your arguments and your arguments lined up in a row like ducks in order to challenge those views. Challenge those views is the role of journalists in an open society. Otherwise, what do? We all pack up and say, there's only one type of voice that needs to be heard. That's mine. If that were the case, then, well, actually, the world would be pretty boring because, you know, people don't want to be listening to Kurt Barling all day long.
But the I'm enjoying listening to it for the next hour. I was hugely enjoying this podcast, actually.
But the reality is, there are other voices. There are always other voices. One of the things that's driven my work over the best part of 30 years is my search for the alternative narrative. Why the alternative narrative? Because I felt very often that journalism is weakened by dominant narratives in newsrooms, which are fueled by people who come from a certain background. In my day at the BBC, it was people educated in Oxbridge or Russell Group universities, and they'd all sit around in a newsroom and say, yeah, this is what the story agenda is for the day. And very rarely did people say, well, actually, no, that's a crock. What we need to be looking at is this, this, and this. They don't generally do that. There's a kind of understanding, an unwritten understanding, that this is what makes the story agenda for the day. We listen to the Today programme in the morning. We'll pick up that and we'll run with that, develop the lines throughout the day. The world's a really complicated place. And the reality is you need those alternative narratives to check that we're not actually just getting one line. Because if we get one line, it ends up being not just dull, but dangerous. You know, what's the point of living in a democracy, in a plural society, if we're only hearing one set of music the whole time?
Well, I don't want to flatter you, but you're already a great guest because you're kind of interviewing yourself and it's great listening to you. You know, you're clearly passionate and know your onions. Let's go back
to... Be careful. Some people might say, my goodness, that man likes the sound of his own voice.
Well, they could say that about me as well. I'm having a great time. But I want to go back to the beginning, if I can, because how did you get into all this? I mean, you did 25 years at the BBC and broke some incredible stories. Just reading that intro earlier is genuinely incredibly impressive about some of the stories that you've covered.
I got into it in a strange way. Well, my grandfather worked for the Daily Mail as a proof puller in the old days.
A proof puller? I don't know what that is.
They're the people who kind of set the metal plates where the, you know, in the old printing days,
wow,
where the, you know, the paper went across the plates and printed the newspaper.
Wow, I've learned something. I've learned something new today.
And he was father of the chapel at the Daily Mail on Fleet Street. And when I was a young boy, 6, 7, 8, I used to go to the Daily Mail parties in the, you know, Christmas and whatever. And I can remember saying to my grandfather, God, I really want to work here, Granddad. It's noisy, the it's smelly. Mail, yeah. Well, in the print room, yeah. You know, it was...
Oh, in the print room, not down the editorial.
No. He was a print man, you know, printer. And, you know, that was... It was exciting, it was noisy, it was smelly, it was hot. They had great camaraderie. And he would say to me, listen, son, you don't want to work down here because, you know, the real power's up there, upstairs. And I'm, what's upstairs, Granddad? Journalists, he said. That's where the real power lies. So he kind of put in my mind that actually being a journalist was something of great worth. He was a working man.
I still believe that to this day.
Yeah, I do too, naturally. But the point is, he planted the seed. Now, some people might say, well, so why don't you go and join a local paper when you were 16? Well, the opportunities came in a different direction. You know, I was quite keen on drama, and I went to the National Youth Theatre in my teens, thought maybe I'd become an actor, tread the boards. The point is that, you know, I kind of fancied myself in that role. But then I suddenly realised when I was in the National Youth Theatre that I would probably spend my entire life speaking somebody else's words, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to speak mine own.
Jeremy Van was in that chair about a year or so ago, and he called it the show-off gene.
Yes, indeed. But I wasn't show-offy enough to want to show off other people's words. I wanted to show off my own. And when I went to university, I decided that actually I was interested in thinking and working through arguments. And I was sufficiently good student to be offered scholarships, which enticed me to stay into postgraduate study, you know, master's degrees, PhDs. And it was only then, it's strange enough, when I started my PhD in 1985, I just got this scholarship for 3 years to do my PhD at LSE. And it was October 1985, and my brother-in-law had just moved to London from the Midlands, and he lived literally about 50 yards from the entrance to the Broadwater Farm estate. And we'd been out for the day, and I took him home in October that night, and within an hour, the place was in flames. And I went down there, tried to rescue him from it, because it was like World War III. I knew Tottenham very well. I saw something which I never imagined I would see. Actually, in the Brixton riots in 81, I was a student undergrad, and I'd seen some of it, and certainly the devastation, but I'd not been right in the heart of it. And it was frightening, number one. But then when I turned on the news and I listened to the news and I read the news in the newspapers over the coming days and weeks and months, I thought, this is a lot of nonsense of a lot of what's being said. They've got no clue about this community. They're misrepresenting that community in the way in which they're creating the narrative. And I thought, you know what, Kurt, if you're going to do something with your learning, do something bloody useful. Mm. Become a journalist, as you promised yourself. Of course, that got delayed because I decided I'd embarked on the PhD. I wanted to finish that. But ultimately, the die was cast.
That was the light bulb moment.
That was the light bulb moment. This is what I have to do. But first of all, get the PhD out of the way. And there was a bit of pride going on there. You know, lots of people said, get a job. Actually, I had an uncle who worked on Manchester Guardian. Still around, actually, he's in his late 80s. And I asked his advice, look, I really want to get on with this. He said, when you have a family, you will not do no PhD. And my grandfather had always said to me, the only real doctors in the world are PhD doctors. So there was all that kind of meeting the expectations, if you like, of the people I respected in the family. Mm. So I carried on with the PhD, got that, and then got a job at the BBC.
That shows you're a completer finisher. How did you get the job at the BBC then?
I wrote about 110 letters, fortunately on LSE letterhead, because I was a lecturer at the time at LSE, just having completed my PhD. And I got two responses, positive responses. I got about 10 responses, most are saying, yes, thank you for your letter, and we shall keep your information on file. I got two responses, one from Samir Shah, who went on to become a senior player at the BBC, and one from Olga Edridge, who is a series producer on Heart of the Matter. Samir Shah said, international relations, PhD, very interesting. I'm a doctor too, but I keep that quiet. I suggest you do too. We've got a new series starting next year called Assignment. It was a foreign affairs program the BBC was just about to launch. I think you'd be really suited to that. So we'll keep you on file, and when that comes along, make sure you keep yourself on our radar. Olga Edridge, meanwhile, said, I like the look of you, and I like the sound of you. Come and work for us for a while on Heart of the Matter and see how you get on. And I took a 3-month contract there. It just so happens remember 1989, big events in 1989. I'm a fluent German speaker. The Berlin Wall came down 3 weeks after I joined the BBC, having come out from my little ivory tower at the LSE. And I was in religious programming. That's where Heart of the Matter was made. And everyone had sent people to Berlin. The Berlin Wall had come down, and virtually every BBC department had sent whoever they could to Berlin. And I remember the religious programmes director doing his nut because he couldn't find anyone in his department to go to Berlin. And suddenly somebody said, here's a fellow who's just arrived and he speaks fluent German. Why don't we send him? And, of course, it was like a baptism of fire. Didn't have a clue how to make television. They wanted a 30-minute film. We're giving you 2 days' advance notice. We'll be there on the Monday. You set it up for us. We'll be filming in East Germany. And I'm like, really? And how am I going to do that? So it was a bit of a baptism of fire. But we got there in the end with a lot of support from other people, including Joan Bakewell, of course, now Baroness Joan Bakewell, who was very generous, actually, and taught me a lot. And that was a great experience at Heart of the Matter, and it enabled me to get access to the documentaries department, and I went on to make a film very quickly after that called we called Tomorrow's Child, about the rights of the child around the world, UN the Year of the Rights of the Child. And, you know, slowly you built up experience and filmmaking experience, less journalistic to begin with, to be fair. But the craft of creating television, I spent 2 or 3 years doing primarily that.
What came next?
Then after that, I got a break on assignment. You know, that conversation I had came around. In fact, I can always remember the interview because I was flying between Bangladesh and Pakistan and Mozambique. And I said, I can't possibly make the interview for assignment because I'm on a plane, off a plane from Zimbabwe on the Friday, and on a plane to Bangladesh on the Sunday. I'm only here for Saturday. So the editor at the time, John Morrison, said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you come over to my house on the way to the airport and I'll do an interview with you there, and we can't offer you the job, but we'll measure you against the other candidates and see how you get on. So I went and did an interview in his front room, and, you know, he took me through my paces, and it helped, of course. I was, I've just been in Mozambique, you know, the war was going, you know, we've been escorted by the military along the Beira corridor and taking flights, you know, fly only 500 feet across the land, and so snipers don't get us, and we're off to Bangladesh to go down into the Delta to find, you know. So the point is, I had great stories, you know. And he said, well, obviously, this is a guy I want on my foreign affairs program. And so I got that break onto the foreign affairs program, and that's where my journalistic experience really start to take off, always with a focus on filmmaking, not, as it were, in a traditional sense, being on the journalism training scheme. Of course, you had to do various training courses whilst you were being put through your paces. Yeah, so assignment was a great experience. You know, we made a film about President Mitterrand 10 years after he'd come
to
power.
You speak French as well, don't you?
I speak fluent French. My PhD was partly at LSE and partly at Sciences Po in Paris. And as a consequence of that, we got the interview with the president, President Mitterrand, because he was a Sciences Po graduate as well. He had no
great story.
He had no interest in talking to the BBC. In fact, nothing more filled Mitterrand with more disgust than actually being interviewed by the BBC.
But didn't you meet his fixer in a bar or something?
I met his old friend who was at university with him.
And he said,
well, what on earth are you doing here? And who are you anyway? You know, obviously I'm brown skinned. Who are you in this Paris bureau and you're speaking fluent French? What's going on? Are you Algerian? Are you Moroccan? I said, no, I'm English. He said, English? And you speak French? What's happening to the world? And I said, well, I tell you what's happening. I'm trying to get the president and he won't talk to the BBC. He's not interested. He said, and have you tried? I said, of course I've been trying for 2 weeks. It's driving me crazy. He said, so how do you speak such good French? I said, well, I was at Sciences Po Paris, and, you know, Sciences Po Paris? You went to the same university as the president, and he won't talk to you? Let me call him up straight away. And he picked up the phone, called his personal assistant, and said, I have a young man here who speaks fluent French, an Englishman, who was at the same university as the president. The president must speak to him. Lo and behold, within 2 days, we had that interview with Mitterrand, and it made
the
film.
What a scoop.
Well, it was a scoop. It wasn't a news scoop, but it was a great way to recognise the value of that bit of my education in France. What a pompous man, though, Mitterrand was, you know.
Yeah,
5 foot three of pomposity.
And
gave nothing away, frankly, in the interview. I wasn't doing the interview, somebody else was, but gave nothing away in the interview, you know, real operator.
But, I mean, the viewer and the listener will have been equally as frustrated as you watching the end result because, you know, I talked to John Humphreys on this podcast a while ago and he said that, I said, why don't you push them a bit more? You know, if they've not answered the question three or four times, why don't you just go in and say, you know, you must answer the question? And he says, because we leave that to the discretion of the listener. They've already made their conclusion.
Yeah, and that's on the Today programme, you know, in a live setting. When you're on a pre-record in the Élysée Palace in France, there's no way the president is going to say to you, if you say, come on, come clean, you're not answering my question, get on with it, he'll just say, cut, bye-bye. So you have to be a little bit diplomatic about how you approach that. The reality is he was not intent on being open. Some politicians are intent on being reasonably open. Mitterrand was not. And, you know, therefore the film, we called him Mitterrand an enigma. That's what he was, a real enigma. After his death, it became even clearer how big an enigma he'd been all his life.
Mm. We have lots of ex-politicians on this podcast, and I always find they're the most open and most cooperative because, you know, they've got something to say then. But when they're in office and in power, I suppose they have to be guarded, don't they?
I believe you were a politician once, weren't you?
Oh, yes, I did a miserable 10 years in local government.
But the point is, you know there's a game to be played, and therefore you play the game.
Oh, it was a miserable
game. One thing about journalists is you don't necessarily need to play that game, and your job is to unpack that game.
So what came next then after that?
After assignment, I did a lot of work on the Money programme. Again, it was a magazine format at that point, and the Money programme enabled me to pick up my journalism skills, develop my filmmaking skills, and the BBC had a way of sending you off to places to do, you know, regional documentary program called First Sight, which gave the opportunity to make longer films. And so working your way through the current affairs machinery, eventually the BBC said, we are intent on having a bimedia approach. Of course, I was in television mostly then. And bimedia meant we want you to work on radio too. So we went across to radio and we were making programs in radio and working on radio programs like Financial World Tonight, Wake Up to Money.
I still listen to Wake Up to Money every morning now.
Yeah. Well,
quarter past five, Adam and Mickey.
Yeah, exactly. And they were good places to learn the art of radio. And eventually, I can remember a BBC senior person saying to me, Kurt, you know, you've been a producer all these years, but you have a great voice. Have you thought about reporting? I said, people have been saying that to me for the last 6 years, but frankly, I wanted to learn the ropes first. And if you say I'm good at reporting, give me some money and I'll go and make a series. And that's what I did for Radio 5 Live, went off and made a series, and suddenly showed that I was able to craft a story and put my voice on it and make it sound pretty good.
And did you feel you'd arrived at that point, that you were now airside, that you were actually...
Not really.
You know, no?
No, no. I love making films, still love making films. So I didn't feel I'd arrived. I just felt that I'd added that string to my bow. And
but it's unusual for people to move from the kind of producer to the airside. I mean, you think of people like Nick Robinson, who famously did it. But traditionally in the industry, you either stay airside, you're the talent on air, or you're the part of the production team.
I felt that at the very beginning, it was really important to understand the business, understand the craft. What makes television good? What makes it impactful? What makes it memorable? And spending all those years as a producer, assistant producer, and then producer, taught me all that I needed to know about making an impact with television, not with you gobbing off on the airways, but crafting either a news report or a documentary. You know, I've won awards for documentaries as well as news reporting. And so for me, it was kind of more than the sum of the parts, but all the parts were needed for me to feel comfortable really punching above my weight, as it were. In the late 90s, the BBC decided to have a series called Black Britain. They felt that stories and people of colour were being underrepresented on the BBC, and one way around it was to use current affairs to start this programme called Black Britain. And they lobbied me for some time to sort of come on board as a bit of a heavyweight reporter. And I resisted it because I didn't want to be typecast. And I thought, well, you know, if the BBC...
Aren't they kind of saying, well, you know, you're a good reporter, but you're also black as well, so come and present this show Black Britain.
Precisely what they were saying.
It doesn't seem very thought through. I mean, don't get me wrong, you're a great journalist.
I don't think it was very thought through, but I thought it through and said to myself, one of the big things that's missing in BBC output and broadcasting output as a whole in Britain are the stories of people of colour. This is an opportunity to introduce those narratives into the broadcast environment. I'm as best suited as anyone to do that. You've got good contact, you've got good connections, people trust you to tell the story responsibly from those communities. Take this opportunity to do it, see how it works. And actually, it worked pretty well. As a consequence of that, I was offered a news correspondent role and became a news correspondent in the BBC newsroom. And that served me well, having made that choice. Now, that doesn't mean I always wanted to do black stories, but, you know, i.e. stories emanating from minority communities. But I recognised that that was an important thing that I needed to do, take you back to the 1985 riots. Why was it important to put my mark? Why was it a light bulb moment? Because I felt those stories weren't being told. You know, it's the same as being a working class lad. Mm. You know, if you're from a mining community, you only saw miners in a certain context on the news, you might want to tell the story in a different way. I felt the same way about working class London. I felt the same way about minority communities. I wanted to put those voices on air when it was appropriate and make sure that their voices were heard loud and clear, because that was whence I came, and I felt I could make an additional contribution to making that effective and impactful.
But you broke some incredible stories during your time there. I mean, what were the most memorable ones for you now?
Well, certainly getting, and one of the reasons I left the BBC in the late 90s was I wanted to make a film about Abu Hamza, because I'd just at the time when radicalisation was, you know, was emerging in the public arena, there were some young men who were arrested in Yemen, and I was sent off as a BBC correspondent to investigate that. Well, that's to report it, actually, go to the mosque and find out from that community who these young men were. And slowly those stories started to emerge, and you kind of recognised there was something going on. Couldn't quite put your finger on it, exactly what was going on. We're talking the late 90s now. But I recognised that something was going on in Britain's mosques that was very unsavoury. And I tried to convince some people at the BBC that it was something that, you know, we should get some time to look at, but there just wasn't the space at that time. And I was getting very frustrated, and I thought, Kurt, time to move on. And
was there a lack of political will?
I just think there was a lack of awareness. I don't think it was politics. I just think there was a lack of awareness. And, you know, people just didn't see it. You know, in the end, journalism, certainly in those kind of institutions, is all about following the paper trail. If you've got somebody who says, I'm working for MI5, and I can tell you this, where's the paper trail on that? You know? Now, maybe if you're the political editor or diplomatic editor and you've got that kind of source, they might listen to you. But little old Kurt Barling, news correspondent, they weren't going to listen to me. So I decided I had to move on. And in fact, I went to make a film for Channel 4, which actually became quite a seminal film, Trouble at the Mosque, for Dispatches, which looked inside some of Britain's mosques and said there is something very bad going on. One of the things was Abu Hamza. So before 9/11, we were saying Abu Hamza's up to no good at Finsbury Park Mosque. Something needs to be done about it. And
but you weren't really heard, were you? You weren't listened to.
Well, actually, strangely enough, that film was being produced throughout 2000 and 2001. And we pretty much had put it to bed by August 2001.
Just before September
just before
the 11th.
September the 11th. I came back from the States from holiday on September the 9th. And lo and behold, September the 11th happened, and the film was put on ice because it was seen to be potentially too not Islamophobic, but would be seen as Islamophobic.
Almost incendiary.
Incendiary. And it was put on ice by Channel 4. Eventually, they broadcast it the following year.
Yeah, because I remember seeing it. So
people
it must
still
have gone
say
out.
To me, from the Muslim community, that was a real moment for them, understanding how they needed to stand up, be counted. And so in that sense, it was a great piece of journalism, you know, because it actually told people something they either didn't know or felt they weren't empowered to get themselves involved in. And it made a change. In fact, the Council of Mosques then decided to have all sorts of regulatory involvement in Britain's mosques through a sort of informal network, because it's not like the Church of England. Mosques don't have that hierarchical structure. But they decided to do something to try and regulate how people behaved in mosques. That wasn't just to do with politics and terrorism. Some of it was to do with financial impropriety. Some of it was to do with the protection of minors, children, sexual abuse allegations and the like. But it needed someone to grab hold of that issue and start to look at how they could give people within mosques the power to challenge those in authority within the mosque, either the mosque committee or the imam himself. So in that sense, it was a film which was ahead of the time, because that was broadcast eventually 2002, and now 14 years later we're still talking about the same issues, but we, if you like, opened the door up for that issue to be explored, no longer as a taboo but a legitimate point of inquiry.
Was Abu Hamza a man to cross? I mean, clearly journalistically you had to, but did you ever fear for your personal safety?
Not really, not at that point. And I think that at that point journalists were very useful to Abu Hamza, less so to Abu Qatada. Certainly he was, he considered himself to be the darling of some people in the media, and he made himself available. And he wasn't in the business of roughing up journalists, because it wasn't in his interest.
Because you were his route to kind of stardom and greater awareness of
correct,
what he was doing.
You know, oxygen of publicity and all of that. And therefore you didn't really fear for your safety. Of course, things changed after 7/7, because then you recognise that it had moved into new terrain, and actually journalists became significant targets, not necessarily in Britain, but certainly internationally, after Al-Qaeda upped the ante with 7/7 and other attacks like that. You suddenly realise actually there's a new way of attracting attention. And actually, if killing a journalist grabs more attention, then let's kill the journalist. You know, because other journalists will come and tell the story. And so the rules of the game changed. And in fact, the deaths of journalists around the world has gone up significantly in the last 20 years, and it's become a much more dangerous. British journalists, of course, have died in the field too, but far fewer than Iraqi journalists and, you know, other journalists and Syrian journalists in the Middle East. It's a dangerous business. I mean, you've done on some of your podcasts looking at those type of issues. So I didn't personally fear for my life. There are other places and venues where I did. I was nearly killed in Nigeria at the end of the last dictatorship, Abacha dictatorship. And I had an AK-47 held to my head and threatened to blow my brains out by some soldier who was high on something or other. And I did really fear for my life there. In fact, it's probably what cured me of wanting to be a foreign correspondent. You know, my wife had just had our third child, and I was thinking, that's not a very good way to be a father, a dead one. I'd much rather be alive and, you know, watch them grow up and do the job there. That was more important to me.
Why did he spare your life?
My fixer, you know, I remember that series it was on recently on Lagos, three-part series, very good series, actually. The fixer on that was my fixer back in the late 99. And he pleaded prostrate on the floor for about half an hour for our lives. And Martin Bell, remember him, had taught me a little trick early on in my career. He said, if you're ever in a foreign place, Kurt, do yourself a favour, put $51 bills in your wallet, and always carry those $51 bills around in your wallet, because, of course, a $1 bill looks the same as a $100 bill. If you've got 50 of them, that's a wad of, you know, real wadge of cash. So anyone who's going to frisk you late at night is going to see a wadge of cash. It could be, you know, $5,000, as it is if you only got $1 bills, it's only $50. I had those $50 in that wallet that night, and out those $50 came. You could see them, you know, practically salivating at the sight of those $50. And that and my fixer prostrate on the floor made them think, we can let these guys move on. What they didn't know was that I had $6,500 stuck in my underpants in a plastic bag.
For protection.
And good job they didn't look in my pants, because otherwise I'd have been over the side of that flyover, dead as a dodo. But, you know, I live to tell the tale, and I do enjoy telling that particular tale.
It's an odd logic, really, because they could have killed you and taken the $50.
Yeah, but that would, you know, you don't know how my fud it is. Is a good old phrase in Nigeria. And light-skinned, you don't know who my father is, could be that I was the son of somebody very important. Now, if I was the son of somebody very important...
They're going to be in bother.
They're going big bother. You live by your wits as a journalist. I was actually undercover. I wasn't accredited because I was filming on something which they wouldn't have given me accreditation for, the smuggling of artifacts out of Nigeria. And as a consequence, I had to be a little bit crafty about how I protected myself.
But even so, I mean, was that a kind of another light bulb moment for you? You've just got the third kid that's just, you know, been born, and there you are, narrowly escaped with your life. Did you think, you know, I have to move on from this and maybe take a desk job in an insurance company or something?
Definitely not a desk job in an insurance company. But I do remember...
It's safe where you're not going to get shot.
I do remember, shortly thereafter, my wife actually did give birth. I delivered the baby, actually. My wife, we had home births, all three children, and the third one came home birth. But my wife, the baby came very quickly. The midwife didn't get there in time. And so I was left literally holding the baby. And I rang up the newsroom in the morning and said, oh, can't come in today because we've just delivered the baby. And, oh, was it okay? How was it? Which hospital? I said, no, it's at home. I delivered the baby myself on the bedroom floor. And George Eakin, who was my colleague at the time, who now works for DCMS, I think, as the head of communications there, rang up all his mates on Fleet Street saying, you never guess what one of my colleagues did. He delivered his own baby. And I got all these calls from the Sun, you know, and the Express saying, oh, I heard you delivered your own baby. And the Sun guys, I don't think, it wasn't in the telephone box, so I don't think it's your kind of story. But the Telegraph rang me up and said, oh, it's amazing, you've delivered a baby. That must have been so terrifying. And I said, have you ever had an AK-47 stuck in your head? That is terrifying.
I don't ever want to experience that.
Delivering a baby is a complete and utter joy. I would never
literally.
Replace, quite literally. Mm. Not many people get that opportunity to do it on their own. In reality, I didn't choose. It just happened like that. But actually, I did it on my own. The midwife arrived. My other children, who were 4 and 6, came in, cut the cord. We were happy families.
When did you kind of decide to move out of journalism then and move it back into academia? How did that happen?
I spent 10 years, 12 years as a special correspondent in London doing all sorts of stories, as you quite rightly said, stories about witchcraft in African churches and the abuse of vulnerable children, doing stories on Broadwater Farm again, did the great film on Who Killed PC Blakelock in 2005. So becoming the master of my domain, if you like, in covering the capital. But, you know, there's a time and place for everything. I felt that it had run its course. If you remember in 2014, Abu Hamza was in prison. He was about to be extradited to the States.
He was in a prison within a prison, wasn't he? In Belmarsh.
In Belmarsh. He was about to be extradited. He was then extradited to the United States. He was going to be put on trial. I said to my MI5 contact back in Finsbury Park Mosque, Reda Hussein, why don't we write a book about our experience and how it was missed and that other decisions could have been taken and Abu Hamza 7-7 may not have happened if those decisions had been taken by the authorities. And it was clear I would not be able to write a book like that as a BBC correspondent because it was slightly polemical. We called it Abu Hamza Guilty. It would have seen as less than impartial in many ways.
Explosive.
Even though we were telling the story as factually accurately as we could.
It was too rich for the babe.
I think it would have been uncomfortable. And so it was time for me to move on. And the reality is Middlesex University wanted a strong practitioner to join their team. I fitted the bill and, you know, there I landed, as it were. It's like riding a bicycle being a journalist. You never forget how to do it. Or if you're a skier, you ski and you never forget how to go on a pair of skis. If you're a journalist, you never forget how to be a journalist. It's in your blood, so to speak. And so you've always got that instinct. So even, you know, we did the Abu Hamza book, written instinctively as a journalist, the racism book, the R word, again, instinctively written as a journalist, drawing on my experience as a journalist, but also my experience as an intellectual in the scholarly sense. So it's a book which is very layered, looking at the history of race and the ideas of race and the mythology of race and the language of race and how we've become trapped in a paradigm which is no longer fit for purpose and how we have forgotten how to negotiate difference because we've locked ourselves into a black and white duality, which for me is not a reflection of the world we actually live in. It's a reflection of a world that was constructed in racist times, and we unfortunately have allowed ourselves to become trapped in that world rather than beginning a new discourse on what it is to negotiate difference.
What society got wrong then in that regard as it is now?
We got trapped by thinking that black is always problematic and that the opposite of black problematic is white. The world is full of grey, and the reality is that, you know, you can't break the world into racism and, you know, non-racists and racists. You know, there are people who are good, there are people who are less good, there are people who are right, there are people who are less right, but it's not a function of black and white. You know, for example, I made a film called The Faster Race, all about whether black men, quote-unquote, run faster because they pick up all the medals in the Olympics. The reality is, we concluded in that film, was nothing to do with blackness. It was to do with genetics, yes, but it was to do with population group genetics. Sometimes people run faster and they're black. Sometimes they're rubbish. Just because you're black doesn't mean you're a good dancer. In fact, my mother's white. And she's a great dancer and was a great sportswoman.
I'm white and I'm a great dancer and a great sportswoman.
There you are. I thought you were a great dancer. You're somewhere where you moved there. But my father was African from Nigeria, two left feet, and he couldn't run if he saved, you know, to save himself. So the black and white thing is a bit of a distraction. That's not to say racism doesn't exist, because we are locked in that way of thinking. We have racialized discourse, and as a consequence, people often see issues through that prism. But Britain is a changing society. That's why I wrote that book. I believe it is. The evidence suggests it is. One simple fact, 140,000 students of colour in our university system at the moment, each year. That's 140,000. What are all those graduates going to do? Some people say, oh, well, they're not at Russell Group universities, are they? There are still very few people at Oxbridge or LSE or Durham of colour. And all those other degrees they're getting are not worth the paper they're written on. Phooey. The reality is young people of colour are exercising their right to dream, to aspire, get the qualifications. They will become leaders in their own field in good time, and that will change who the decision makers are. Some people won't like that. Others won't give a monkey's. The world will change as a result in this country, and that needed to be recorded. That change needed to be recorded. That's what I've done in that book. The latest book, which is looking at Germany's descent into dictatorship in the 1930s.
Translated into German as well, German, very proudly.
Yeah, indeed. It's a book which tries to say, look, we've faced these issues in the past in different contexts, in terms of extremism, in terms of shutting down debate, in terms of young people being captured by false prophets. So let's not imagine we have to reinvent the wheel. We don't. We have to understand those lessons from the past and apply them today. Race is just one of those issues which I think equally needs to understand the lessons of the past and try to apply the lessons today.
So penultimate question, Kirk, because we're running out of metaphorical tape, as I like to say, is does the kind of lifestyle of an academic suit you? You know, you've been a hard-nosed TV journalist, correspondent. Do you feel that your kind of lifestyle choice now as an academic, how does that work? Because it gives you the freedom to write other books. You know, you're churning out the journalists and the students of tomorrow. That's great. But does it allow you the time and space to do all this extracurricular stuff?
The reality is the space is there for you to exploit. Now, you know, you could sail off into the sunset and, you know, have a big fat cigar and just cruise. I don't know what, actually there's a cruise control in my car. I very rarely use it. I don't quite know what cruising is, and I certainly wouldn't go on one of those cruises around the Mediterranean. I don't want to cruise. I never wanted to cruise. I never will cruise. I only know one speed, that's fast forward. And the reality is, if I've got a project in mind, I'll get it done, and I'll get it done in journalism time, not academic time. Now that means that I've got to exploit that space to the max in order to do interesting projects, bring that experience back into the university, show people that universities are connected with the broader community, ensure that there's a strong relationship between a university like Middlesex and its hinterland, as it were, and show people that actually university is an opportunity to change the pathway of life for individuals, and that from a personal point of view, keep my foot in both camps as much as I can. It's a challenge, but it's not impossible.
So final question then, Kurt, is what's next for you?
I've never planned life as if it's going to be, you know, well, by the time I'm 55, I'm going to do this. By the time I'm 60, I'm going to do that. And by the time I'm 65, I'm going to, you know, take my pension and move to the Isle of Wight. I never planned my life like that. So I'm not sure what's going to happen over the next 10 years or 15 years.
Because there's a hunger within you and a restlessness, good source.
What I can tell you is, I mean, I've got a journalistic instinct. I'm looking for stories. I'm looking for projects where I can use those projects to make a difference. It just so happens that the difference isn't just in the public sphere, outward facing. Now it's also internal facing in the university. And an important thing is to make sure the things that I do choose connect those things up. So the Hidden Soldiers of Empire exhibit, which is travelling around schools, produced mainly by university students, is a way of facing outwards, but also facing inwards. The film that I just made is a similar exercise. I've got an exhibition that's going to be running at Goldsmiths using the artwork from my cousin, who was murdered back in 1982, who's in the book, The R Word, as a way of exploring aspiration and representation. So always finding these projects which can keep debate alive, stimulate debate, getting people to think in a different way about the world in which they live in, and understand the world not in the way that it's been told to you in the past, not the way you think it ought to be based on past practice, but how you might want it to be based on what your values and norms are.
Kurt, it's been an absolutely fascinating interview. Thank you ever so much for your time. I think you're a total legend.
Been a pleasure being here.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!